Hello and welcome to Ed Talks, the podcast from King Edward School Birmingham and King Edward's High School for Girls, where I talk to old Eds who left the school and pursued lots of wonderful careers across the globe. Today, I'm joined by an old Ed from the girls' school who's currently in London, but spends a lot of her time over in the United States. It's Melanie Etty, a Fulbright scholar completing a Master of Public Health degree at Harvard University. Mel, hello and welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Ben. Well, that was a very generous introduction. Thank you.
Well, it's wonderful because it's, you know, obviously we're recording this. You're in the UK at the moment.
Yeah.
You're in London. I live in Liverpool. We're recording this remotely. But one of the things I love about this podcast is just how far flung old Eds do end up going with their careers. You know, there's not that many people that stay in Birmingham these days. So before we move on to Harvard and the work you do, I'd also like to talk to you about the time you spent in Uganda as well in 2020, if that's all right, because that sounds really interesting. But let's talk first of all about your school days and what Birmingham was like, because I think did you leave school in 2007?
Yes.
Okay, so we were not too far apart then in our school careers. Talk to me about Birmingham. What's the Birmingham that you remember growing up in the kind of early noughties?
Yeah, so I'm from Bearwood in Birmingham, which is sort of adjacent to Edgbaston and Harborne, but sort of its own little place. And it still, to this day, remains home, no matter where I've been. And yeah, I look back on my time at King Edward's really fondly. You know, it was a time where I made some of my best friends. And I think it was really the time, I think those years were really kind of my formative years. They were the years that I really became, or started to become, the person I am today. I developed my interests. I used to play a lot of netball. I do less so now, but at the time I really loved netball. And I just think it was, I don't know, I had so many experiences that really shaped who I am today, got me thinking about what I wanted to do and instilled the belief in me that I could do those things. So yeah, I look back on the time really fondly.
How much of that do you credit to the school? It comes through a lot in this podcast that the school and the way that the teachers not just kind of taught but interacted and all the other stuff that we could do, that it isn't just somewhere that we went to learn about, I don't know, biology or English. You know, you do learn a lot more, and there is a kind of belief system that you do start to develop. Do you credit that to the school, or do you just credit that to the age and growing up? Like, how much can you credit back to KEHS?
So I really credit it to the school. I have this image of myself, it's kind of like a sliding doors moment, where it's like the Mel that went to King Edward's and the Mel that didn't. And I think about those two trajectories, and I really think they would have been different. And as you said, it's kind of like a belief system. I think, you know, particularly growing up in Bearwood, which is very small, and being a young girl of colour, I think there were so many things that I thought about, and I was like, can I do that? You know, is that achievable? And I think during the 7 years, I certainly started to set my sights higher. And I was like, I think I can achieve those things. And I think just being able to, just being around people who believed in you, you started to believe in yourself. And I think, yeah, I really credit that to the school. And as you said, it was beyond learning English, learning geography. It was just, yeah, I guess having belief instilled in you in a way that you could carry that forward and believe in yourself after you've left the school. So, yeah, I really believe so. Special place.
Let's talk about Birmingham then, because I've got a friend who's come up to stay in Liverpool with me for a few days. He's from Birmingham. And he said, oh, have you seen Broad Street recently? So you can't drive up Broad Street now, apparently. It's changed massively, even in just a few years. But what was it like, kind of, you know, obviously we worked incredibly hard, Mel, at school, and we were always doing our homework on time and thinking about academia. But there were times that we'd find ourselves in town having a good time. What was the kind of the social side, and what were you interested in kind of culturally in the city itself?
Yeah, I think we obviously grew up in the time before mobile phones, and I think about that a lot. Kind of leaving home, you call your friend and you're like, make sure you meet me outside of House of Fraser at 2 p.m. and you both had to be there at that time.
We were the last, really. Like, I mean, I remember I had a phone, but it was a brick. It was on the Nokia brick phones. And it was because Mom was terrified that I was getting on the train and going all the way on the cross city line for 40 minutes on a train. You know, I was like, everyone else is doing it. It'll be fine. No, have a phone. And I remember the first few weeks kind of having to text my Mom when I got to university train station. I'm here, Mom. You're doing well. But it wasn't like, it's not like phones now, is it?
No.
It was kind of.
And
yeah,
I always ran out of credit as well. So
constantly.
I'd be like, I have nothing left to text my friend to tell them I'm going to be 30 minutes late. But you just stood there and waited. But yeah, the city centre has changed a lot. And my older sister actually lives there in the Jewellery Quarter at the moment. So I do go and visit her and I look around and I'm like, oh my gosh, so much has changed, but hopefully for the better. So when I speak to my friends, I'm like, just you wait till 2023, probably. Like, you'll come to Birmingham and you'll love it.
Yeah.
Yeah, but yeah. No.
Well, I a couple of weeks ago, just in the last series of this podcast, I interviewed Ian Metcalf, who is the chair of the Commonwealth Games. And we were talking about what the Commonwealth Games is going to do for Birmingham as a city. And we were talking about the kind of, you know, obviously the infrastructure that's built, which is, it can be used for years to come. But we also talked about the kind of emotional benefit of having such a world. Everybody knows what the Commonwealth Games is. The world is going to be watching. And Birmingham is talking about the kind of opening ceremony. And it's very Birmingham. And it has us on the world stage. It does feel like perceptions are changing all the time, because I totally agree with you. I had that when I went to, you know, away from Birmingham, people immediately like, Birmingham back at you. You're like, right, okay, yeah, whatever. But it really does feel like it's taking a giant step forward at the moment.
Yeah.
And I feel like, you know, we've been a bit behind places like Manchester and even like culturally Liverpool sometimes. And, you know, we just need a few more case studies to be proud of. But it's coming.
It is coming.
Tell me, what A-levels did you do?
So I did maths, chemistry and biology, and I did AS Latin as well.
Yeah, okay.
Which I enjoyed.
Great. And what came next?
Then I moved to Bristol, actually. So I went to medical school in Bristol and spent 6 years there and really enjoyed living there as well. It's a very multicultural place. And it's like a lot to do. Quite different to Birmingham, actually. It's a lot smaller. So I guess things like the city centre were smaller than Birmingham city centre, but it had so many kind of like little interesting places, like independent cafes and like bars and things like that. So yeah, I really enjoyed it there and spent there for 6 years. And actually, when I considered staying there after I finished medical school, but then my sisters lived in London, so then I wanted to come and live with them. So moved down to London and then did my first few years of training there and lived with one of my sisters. She actually can't get rid of me. I'm always training behind her.
That's lovely, though. I'm in Liverpool now, but both of my brothers are here.
So you understand.
It's nice when these things... Yeah, absolutely. It's nice when these things work out. So you've trained and you've gone to London.
Yeah.
And because obviously, you know, you are in the UK at the moment.
But yeah.
You're now in the state. When do you think we should start talking about the Fulbright scholarship? Oh. A bit further along? Am I jumping the gun?
No, I guess. Okay. So I guess it's so funny. So when I was thinking about our conversation today and I was like, how can I really describe my career? Because I guess it's so true that when you look back on things, it's not like, you know, when I was at medical school, I was like, this is where I want to end up. But it's just, I guess, lots of small pivots and lots of small decisions that have sort of led me to being at Harvard. And I guess when I was at medical school, I think it's quite a challenging environment. And there's a real mix of people. There are people who know where they want to be, and you know, they want to be surgeons, or they know they want to, I don't know, be cardiologists. And I don't think I was ever like that. I think I was quite open to a lot of things, and I kind of took electives and did things based on what I was interested in, just to explore and just to see if I liked it. And I feel like that was a really important experience, and kind of like ruling in and ruling out what I wanted to do. And when I was there, you have an opportunity to do an extra year of study. And I did mine in microbiology. And I think that was when I was like, I think I really like infectious diseases. They're really interesting. And my family are from Cameroon. And I think that has allowed me, well, firsthand, I've had experience of, you know, family members or extended family members and family friends like dying from really treatable infections and conditions that, you know, we would treat very easily here in the UK. So I think that year was quite formative. It got me thinking about infectious diseases, particularly in a kind of global perspective. But I also really liked obstetrics and gynecology, which is like, they're two quite opposed specialties. But I also explored that, and I did an elective in obstetrics. I discovered I did not like operating, and I think that's probably a big part of the job. But I think from then, I really became interested in women's health, and I think it really dawned on me how the vulnerability of pregnancy and actually what women go through. And I felt like that was also something really important. So I feel like in medical school, those were the two important self-discoveries that I made. And I kind of, but I wasn't fixed on anything. And then, so I went through my kind of general medical training, kind of thinking about what I wanted to do. And then I did the diploma in tropical medicine, and I actually did a course that was kind of like global health, humanitarian medicine, and I really loved it. So it was run by MSF, Medicine Sans Frontières, and it was just amazing. Like, we had talks from people who worked in like with refugees, or you know, on expeditions in like you know the Arctic, you know, really amazing things. And it really, I think that really just made me think, you know what, I feel like I would thrive kind of working internationally, and I really want to do that. And then I continued on with my medical training, again, still thinking about what I wanted to do. And I finished my general medical training, and I think that was the point where it was like, I would either do specialty training, and that is like a long kind of 5+ years training post, or I could maybe try my hand at something else. And I kind of saw that as the kind of my last chance to maybe try something else. And I remember kind of walking home, I was on a night shift, and I was like, let me see if I can find something. So I walked home, and throughout the day I kind of googled, and I was on a random Australian website, Australian medical jobs posting website. And I found this post for a job in Uganda. And actually, the job was based at St. George's University in London. But I don't know why it was on this Australian notice board. So I clicked on it, and the job was, or the job advert was closing the following day. So after my night shift, I sat there, wrote my personal statement, updated my CV, and sent it in. And then that was like, again, another sliding doors moment where I think about if I hadn't looked on that, or somehow stumbled onto that Australian jobs notice board, I wouldn't have found this. And I got the job, and yeah.
So did you know exactly what you were applying for at that
point? Yes. Yes.
So, yeah.
Oh, sorry.
So what was the job then?
Oh, yeah. So it was a research fellowship in microbiology in Uganda. And it was working on a project that was looking at an infection called Group B streptococcus in babies in Uganda. So here in the UK, we can easily swab pregnant women to see if they carry this bacteria. And if they do, they're given antibiotics during labor to kind of eradicate the infection or the colonization. But that's just not feasible in Uganda. So it was a really big project looking at lots of different aspects of the infection. So yes, so I secured this research fellowship in microbiology in Uganda, and it started in 2020. And then I remember sitting, talking to a colleague in January 2020. So I was due to go out in February 2020. And obviously at that time, the reports of an unknown pneumonia had already started to circulate. And I was talking to my colleague, and I guess the uncertainty, I don't know, maybe I'm too much of a risk taker, but I thought it will be fine. And I went out there in February 2020. And then by March, we were in lockdown. And I was in lockdown out there. But actually, the experience was really, was a really interesting one. So I went out there to work on this Group B Streptococcus project. And actually, it turned into working on a project looking at the spread of COVID-19 among pregnant women in Uganda. So yeah, I think it was challenging. It was not what I was expecting, but it was certainly worthwhile.
Just before we move on, like, what was it like, you know, a pandemic in Africa? Because obviously over here we were, the news was incredibly consumed what was happening in Europe. You know, it was, you know, this is happening in Italy, there's lockdown in Italy, this is now spreading through Europe, it's coming towards us, was the kind of feeling, this is going to happen to us soon. We weren't really looking, I suppose the kind of news from America was coming through more, but there wasn't a lot of reporting on how the pandemic was being handled in, you know, Africa, for example. I mean, is it the same? Is it the same kind of feeling? Have you got the Prime Minister on the telly doing an address to the nation, and is everyone panic buying loo rolls? Like, what's the feeling over there? Like, how was it to be in lockdown in Uganda?
Yeah, so actually, from when I arrived in February, I think they were taking it very seriously. So I arrived in mid February, and you know, there were thermal cameras checking people's, so I had my temperature checked. I had to declare my travel history, and you know, I think at that time, if you had been to Asia, you would go for additional, I mean, not testing, but you know, something would happen. And that was even, I guess, before the first case was, I think, even discovered in Africa. But they took it very seriously. And I think, you know, even at that time, I think there were still some cases of Ebola in Uganda near the border of Congo. So I think their history of kind of, well, not pandemic, but epidemics, I think they took it very seriously. So yeah, so they were very strict there, I have to say. So you could not enter a public building without a mask. You had to have your temperature checked. You had to cleanse your hands, you know, going into a shop, going anywhere. And I think there was, yeah, a lot. I have to say, just kind of having been here and being in Uganda, people there were very compliant with the measures, I think, because they understood the consequences of not being so. And whilst, I mean, I think the jury is still out as to why, you know, COVID didn't spread as, you know, rapidly during 2020 throughout Africa. And I think there's like lots of different theories. You know, is it that, you know, the people are very young, and so like they, you know, they maybe had the disease but then just weren't manifesting symptoms, or is it under testing and under reporting? But I do think that
could
a lot
be climate as well. Could it be climate? It feels like the kind of, you know, the winter months here in the UK are worse for case numbers than the summer months.
Yeah, it could be actually.
I'm a podcast producer. I don't know why I'm trying to give theories to you, as someone who has literally studied this 4 years. But yeah, okay, but it's interesting. The compliance side of it is interesting. I think that kind of history, and they said that about kind of. I had a friend who went to Japan a few years ago, and he came back and he said, oh, you know, that they used to walk around, you know, before any of this, before COVID was a thing, you know, people walk around the cities. I think people assumed it was kind of pollution reasons, but it was, of course, you know, SARS and everything. It is kind of more recent experience of things that can spread very, very quickly, isn't it? And I don't think that we've, I mean, what is the last case of something like this in the UK?
Probably the Spanish flu. In 1918, right. I really think so. There's been the ongoing threat of bird flu. And actually, I think there was a case of bird flu that was found a couple of days ago. But in terms of epidemics, outbreaks, I think, the UK has been very lucky. We haven't really had anything like that. And many countries in Africa, Uganda included, have. So they understand the potential consequences. So things were very strict. And yet we had a presidential address every few weeks as well. But I think it was tough. I think obviously there's less of a kind of social insurance out there. And I think the lockdown was very challenging. So it was hard to witness that firsthand, I will say. Definitely the experience was different to the experience when I came back. Challenging, but it was worthwhile being there, but definitely challenging.
So you're back in the UK, December 2020. Let's talk about the Fulbright scholarship, because it's something that was set up after the Second World War, wasn't it? The Fulbright scholarship. And every year, a certain amount of international... Well, you know what? I'm not going to explain it. You tell me about the Fulbright scholarship and your experience of it.
Yeah, so the Fulbright scholarship, I think they celebrated their 70th year very recently. And it was set up by an American to strengthen ties between the US and the UK by promoting intercultural understanding with many countries around the world, not just the UK. So they support a number of Americans to go to other countries around the world to study, to teach, to lecture, to do research, and then also support people from around the world to come to the US to do the same. So the US-UK Fulbright Commission are currently supporting me to study in the US, and I applied for a scholarship, a postgraduate scholarship, of which there aren't too many, but I would still say it's worth applying if someone has to get one.
I did a bit of research, and this is not thousands of people that get this. It's hundreds of people, isn't it?
Every
year, the competition must be pretty bloody high. Yeah.
So I think in the UK, I think every year about 15 people get a scholarship, a postgraduate scholarship. And it was quite a rigorous process. It's a really long application form, and you had to write two essays, one that talks about you and sort of your journey to where you are now, and then one that describes what you want to do. And so I really had to think hard about, who I was. And I think that's why I can talk about my journey, because I think
the whole thing's just been reading the essay.
No, but I did a lot of soul searching year, and really thinking about my purpose. I don't know, it sounds very cliched, but
I am currently going through exactly the same process, to the point where I'm like, all these books arrive and my fiance Jen will be like, what is this? Okay, it's the Daily Stoic, I'm learning about stoicism. Why? I'm like, I don't know, I've just got this desire at the moment to find out who I am and why I'm supposed to be here. So no, I totally understand. Yeah. I'm there too.
Yeah, so I mean...
Just from our conversation, you've pursued work because you've been interested in it. You've kind of taken... We had Beth Heaven. I'm not sure. You might know
Yes,
Beth.
Yes.
She was kind of in and around the same year.
Yeah.
She now works at Disney. She did biochemistry at university because she was interested in it. She applied and got a job in one of the big top four accountancy firms, didn't go for it. Ended up, she's worked for Amazon. Like, she's just kind of followed her interests. And now she's in a place where she absolutely loves her job. She loves what she does. She's got it's not just about kind of the job itself. She feels like, we were talking about the princess strategy is what we briefly discussed, and how actually, what should Disney be representing now in princesses? And actually, princesses are strong and they are powerful. And I love that she's just, everything that she has done to this point has led to where she is, but it's never been a predefined path for her. It's never, I want to be here and do this. And it's always been, I want to follow my passions and then see where that takes. It feels like that's very similar to your story. And may, you know, does that come down to, is that a King Edward's thing? Is that a kind of, you know, have the confidence to follow your passions? And,
you know, I really, it must be, because I think, you know, I feel probably a lot of my medical school colleagues were like, what is Mel doing? I was always kind of going against the grain. I was always like, you know, I think I want to do this. I think I want to do this. And I was never, you know, held down by what I should do, you know, as defined by someone else or the powers that be. I wanted to be passionate about the things that I did do. And I also was not afraid to try something that maybe wouldn't work out, you know, if that makes sense. So a lot of the things that I've done have been, you know, I kind of describe my career like this, like, I don't know if you, like, kind of like a snake on a Nokia 3310. It's kind of like lots of really small pivots, and it's not ever been a straight line. And I think, I'm kind of, and maybe it is a King Edward's thing. I'm definitely have not been afraid to go against the grain and do something that's slightly different. And I don't know, when I have thought about my career, it's never been like, I want to end up here. I think I've very much stayed in the moment, and I've thought about like what I am doing at that time and what, you know, how, what I'm learning from that experience. And I think having that intentionality about each experience I have had has meant that when I was writing an essay about me and who I am and what I want to do and the, you know, what I've done so far, I could talk about each one of those things and the value it added without it being, you know, forced or like trite. You know, it was the truth. You know, each one of the steps that I've taken, and that's not to say that, you know, I've loved every single thing I've done, but certainly the big things I've done. So I think the things I've mentioned before, so the diploma in tropical medicine that I did with the global health and humanitarian medicine course, and also working in Uganda, those are probably the two big things. I think those were just like so pivotal to kind of me getting the scholarship and studying at Harvard. So I guess from that, I would say, like, don't be afraid to go against the grain. You know, if it's something that you feel is important, go for it. You know, it's part of the bigger picture. Sometimes the bigger picture isn't always apparent at the beginning, but, you know, eventually you'll end up somewhere and you'll be like, okay, I'm really happy here. And it sounds like that's what happen with Beth. So
that was the essay about the kind of the reflective looking back. What was in your essay looking forward?
It was probably much of the same, but just in reverse and projecting into the future. But I really have a passion for infectious diseases, and I particularly, given the burden of diseases in Africa, and given my like strong family ties to Africa, I really feel passionately about kind of improving the burden of disease there. And I guess over time, and actually this, I didn't actually realize how much I was invested in women's health and maternal health actually until I went to Uganda and I started working on this project. And I was working in a government a maternity hospital in Uganda, and you really kind of witness firsthand the challenges that pregnant women in the global south, so resource limited parts of the world, what they go through to deliver babies. And it kind of ignited a passion that perhaps was already there, but I hadn't, you know, really realized it. And I think for me, I came into this, so I'm doing a Master's of Public Health in Global Health. And actually, it's a really great program, because within that, you can really look at lots of different things. And I think within my program, I've chosen to focus on infectious diseases, but also maternal health. And yeah, I think that was really what I stated in that essay, hopefully in a kind of cogent and persuasive way. Yeah. I'm still...
It's the second time I've had a conversation. Before on the podcast, I've spoken to Professor Marion Knight, and we talked a lot.
Oh, wow.
She is a maternal and child researcher,
yes,
and public health physician. Have you ever listened to that episode? Go and have...
She's a big name, like a huge name. Huge,
yeah,
name.
Yeah, it was I loved chatting to her. It was a great conversation. Did you know that she went to the school?
I didn't know that.
There you go. She left in... Back end of the 80s.
Oh my gosh. I did not know that. Oh, wow.
Yeah, they have a list of that. All the big names on the Ed Talks podcast.
That's
what we put on the poster. All the big names.
Yeah.
No, it was a great episode. And she was talking about how the kind of why she wanted to go into that. And it seems like linking back to what you were talking about and kind of your family ties to Africa, is it almost, it's not just about the work, is it? There's a cause here. There's a purpose bigger than I enjoy my day-to-day life in this career.
Yeah, I would say so.
Which is great.
Yeah, I guess, I mean, people find their purpose, I guess, through so many different means. And I guess for me, yeah, it was sort of personal. It was my family and the experiences that I've had, or, you know, the what I've witnessed growing up, you know, my parents receiving phone calls of family members passing away, you know, I guess those things kind of stay with you. And yeah, I guess it was, for me, I used those experiences and reflected on them to think, well, how can I make a difference, you know, in this region of the world? And I guess for me, I would love to go back to Cameroon and work there in some capacity. And I know there are some challenges. There's a lot of civil conflict at the moment, but it's still kind of one of my driving passions. And I hope one day I can achieve it. That would be wonderful.
Hi, I'm Salma.
And I'm Shweb.
We're student fundraisers talking to you about the Assisted Places Fund.
So, I suppose you're wondering, why should you donate to the Assisted Places Fund?
Essentially, we want to help give others the opportunities we were both fortunate enough to have and give them access to our wide-ranging curriculum and ambitious co-curricular programme.
Thank you for listening. And to give, visit the Old Edwardian website.
Mel, I wanted to talk to you a bit about Harvard and what it was like to be at world-famous Harvard University. But you have a course starting very soon.
No,
I imagine being...
It starts at 1:30, so I've still got some time.
Oh, okay, great. I see. You can't be late for a Harvard course. I mean, you shouldn't be late for anything, but for a Harvard course especially. What's it like, the differences between a UK and an American? You know, is it really cool to say, like, I study at Harvard? Have you got the top? Have you got the jumper with Harvard across there?
So I haven't got one, but I before I was coming back, I received a call from my mom, and she was like, "Mel, make sure you bring me back a hoodie with with Harvard on it." So I've got one for her.
Nice.
You know, I have to say I have really enjoyed my first semester there, and I think it's a real melting pot of. And I maybe it's just the course I'm doing, which is global health. So there's a real mix of people from so many parts of the world, and there's a lot of innovation. As you know, I've met some professors that have really changed the way I think about the world and about life and about, you know, health. So yeah, I think again, this is another one of those experiences where I feel like it has, you know, a sliding doors moment, and this will kind of nudge me and put me on a trajectory that, you know, I don't know, I don't want to overplay, but I really feel like it has in a way changed my life. It's definitely changed the way I think, and will probably change the way I practice going forward. But yeah, it is cool, particularly in the fall, going through the quad with a latte in hand. I don't know. Reminds me of the Gilmore Girls. But yeah, no, I mean, it's rigorous. It is tough, but yeah, I feel like it's been a really worthwhile experience. I've really enjoyed it.
Mel, it's been great to talk to you. I always ask the same question at the end of this podcast. As I said to you before, you know, we've got old Eds listening to this all over the world, which is great. It's mad to see some of the places that people are listening to this, actually. In fact, there's even a place I'd never even heard of when I looked at the list of countries where people are tuned in from, which it's one of those things where you're like, how have I got to 33 years old and I didn't even know an entire country existed? But also current students are listening to this as well. So what would you say is the kind of characteristic that has served you best throughout your time since leaving King Edward's? It can be something that, you know, going back to that kind of the values we were talking about at the beginning that was instilled there. It doesn't have to be, but just a characteristic that you think has served you well as you've gone on your Nokia Snake of a career.
I've thought about this question a lot. So I would say resilience. I feel like resilience is so important, and it's so funny, you know, I have sat here and I've described, I've kind of given an abridged version of my career, but I've left out the kind of the downsides and, you know, the not so nice things that have happened to me, and it happens to everyone. And I think one of the most important things is just recognizing that things may not always go how you plan, but bouncing back from that and not taking that to be as, indictment on your inadequacy, but actually just to recognize that that wasn't the right time for you. So when I'd finished my general medical training, I actually did apply for specialty training in infectious diseases, and I didn't get the job that I wanted, and I was so disappointed. But actually, you know, I think about, again, another Sliding Doors reference. I don't know if many people
watch this film now. I haven't watched it for years. Also, I need to get it back on.
And also, it was made in 1998, so I'm not sure many of the current will no, but go and watch it.
If you haven't, it's a classic. Gwyneth Paltrow at her best.
Yes. But, you know, I was so disappointed in that moment. But actually, I used that time. I reflected on it. And I thought, actually, this might be the opportunity that I could go and work abroad. I'd always wanted to do that. And, you know, that just set off the cascade that, led to me studying at Harvard. So I feel like resilience is just such an important characteristic to have. And, you know, being able to bounce back from disappointment, I think, will serve you well. The path to success certainly is not linear. So, yeah, that's really what I would suggest. I don't know. Is resilience a characteristic? I guess.
You know, it's funny because the amount of people that say variations of the same thing is unbelievable. No matter what field they have gone into, no matter what stage they are in their career, so many people say tenacity, resilience, you know, the ability to just kind of keep going. And yeah, I think it is. And I do think it's, me personally, I do think it's something that can be developed. I think it's one of those, you know, things that, unfortunately, sometimes like you say, bad things will happen and disappointments will come along. And you have to develop. It's almost not an option, is it? That's why I suppose, is it a characteristic? You've got to develop it almost. If you want to succeed, you've got to. There's no other option. You've got to be resilient.
And I think for me, I always think when things don't go my way, I just think, you know what, actually, that opportunity or that was not meant for me. I really do believe that, you know, I just feel like things will happen. Things that are right for you will happen for you. And if things don't go your way, don't worry. You know, there may be something more amazing around the corner. And I feel like the last 3 years have definitely shown that for me. So I would encourage everyone to kind of, remain tenacious and practice resilience. It's just so important. So, so important.
Mel, I hope you enjoy the rest of your time in the UK before jetting back to Harvard University. Melanie Etty, it's been fabulous to talk to you. Thank you ever so much for your time.
Thank you so much, Ben. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you for listening to Ed Talks. I hope that you've enjoyed today's conversation. If you have, it would be great if you could subscribe to this podcast on whatever app you're listening on, so you can keep up to date with future episodes. And if you're listening on Apple Podcasts, then we'd really appreciate it if you could leave your feedback in the review section. If you're listening on a platform where you can't leave your comments, then please do email me with your feedback. My email address is ben@soundrebel.co.uk. If you would like to feature on this podcast as a guest, then please email Adelaide Bailey at the Development Office. Her email address is aab@kes.beeham.sch.uk. That's aab@kes.beeham.sch.uk. She's also the person to email with any news that you think should be featuring in Old Ed's publications, either in print or online. Finally, if you think a podcast would enhance the communications of your business, organisation or charity, then I'd love to talk to you about producing it. My email address again is ben@soundrebel.co.uk. Thank you again for listening, and I hope you'll join me again.